This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. And on this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from Coralie Hughes, who is the co-author of The Dressage Horse Optimized. And then later on in our education segment, Sarah Martin will be back, this time to tell us how to choose between a snaffle and a double bridle. That's in conjunction with her article in the May issue of the USDF Connection magazine. And then finally, we have our second part of our four-part series on back pain in dressage horses. All that to come later on in the program. But first of all, a message for members working towards their rider awards. A new feature on the USDF website is the ability for those who have been earning their scores for bronze, silver, or gold medals to check their status for the awards on the website at usdfscores.com. And also, the prize lists for the 2016 Great American Insurance Group USDF Regional Championships are now available on the Regional Championship Competitors page on the website. As you start planning to attend your Great American Insurance Group USDF Regional Championship, please refer to this page for helpful resources and the latest information. Each Great American Insurance Group USDF Breeders' Championship Series Final competition will now be holding a Materiel Championship as well. One championship class will be offered for 3-year-olds, and one championship class will be offered for 4- and 5-year-olds. You can review the USDF BC program rules for eligibility and qualification requirements on the website at usdf.org. And now our first guest this week is co-author of The Dressage Horse Optimized, Coralie Hughes, who joins us to talk about the Masterson method and how it can benefit dressage horses. Coralie brings her lifelong experience with horses and her love for teaching to her work as a Masterson method practitioner and advanced level instructor. The Masterson method has brought Coralie a new way to understand her performance horses, influenced her riding technique, and helps her to keep her horses performing at their very best. Coralie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to talk about something which is actually a very interesting topic. It's something that's new to me, the Masterson method. Tell us a little bit about the background to this and how you became involved.
Sure. The Masterson method is equine bodywork that uses the horse's response to our touch, how we touch them in the practice of the Masterson method, to release tension and also to restore normal range of motion in the key junctions of the body that most affect performance. Now, I'm a longtime dressage rider after having worked hard in lots of other disciplines. Dressage is certainly my current passion. And after trying everything else, I found the Masterson method, looking for something to help my horses perform at their best and most importantly, to stay healthy and sound. The Masterson method is truly unique in that it is a multimodality method that works very deep in the horse's musculoskeletal system without using heavy pressure or force to do the work. The horse does the releasing of tension. We just facilitate it through the application of the method. There are no high-velocity thrust movements. It's absolutely not chiropractic, and it's safe for amateurs to learn.
Well, that's interesting. It's safe for amateurs to learn, but this must have come from a professional setting, I would imagine. What is the history to it?
Well, Jim Masterson worked as a groom with on the A circuit, the jumping A circuit, and he started following around all the different kinds of body workers that were hired to come in. And he started noticing, since he's an extraordinarily sensitive individual toward animals, he started noticing that when you did this, the horse did that. And he started asking questions and realized that there were releases, that there were signs of releases that the horse would use to demonstrate releases of tension when something was done to the horse that helped him release tension. He became fascinated with that and started incorporating concepts and experimentation, actually, in the course of being a groom on the A circuit. And then they started hearing back from the jumpers, oh my gosh, my horse jumped me out of the tack today. I wonder what's going on. And he was very pleased to find this out. And then at some point, people started realizing that Jim was doing wonderful things to their horses, and then people wanted to learn how to do it. And so then it became a method, because Jim Masterson has extraordinary sensitivity and a real gift for understanding animals and how they communicate, and a sensitivity to feel the release of tension.
So,
and that's where it came from.
So would you come to him then, or someone who's practicing this, with symptoms that you would present of the horse's behavior or movement that you would, as you would to your veterinarian?
Absolutely. And as a practitioner, because I'm a practitioner as well as an instructor, I will want to know if there's anything going on of a medical nature, because we want to be partners with vets. We're not in competition. Certainly would never replace a veterinarian. But the best thing is to do body work on a regular maintenance schedule to keep horses in top form. But the horses tell you loud and clear when they need their muscle body work. For example, if my horse knows how to do the half pass, but today I just can't get good crossing in one direction. Muscle imbalance and negative levels of tension in the muscles involved in the half pass can be the culprit. And such tension builds over time, and then it reaches a threshold point, and suddenly it's very difficult for the horse to do what he already knows how to do. Or if I'm working on starting a new movement with a horse as a regular part of their ongoing training, keeping the muscles healthy and the whole system balanced helps the horse more correctly develop muscle and the coordination necessary for the new balance point and the new suppleness that is necessary for the new exercise I'm teaching. Or I get calls from folks all the time to come work on their horses for all kinds of reasons. From the rider's perspective, they'll call because the horse's back is tight and sore, and he feels so rigid longitudinally now, and I just can't get anything done. Very often the Masterson method will help that horse. I get calls when the horse has gotten really stiff in the neck or the pole or the shoulders are locked up, or they just can't bend well anymore, or they can't step under well enough with the left hind leg. I mean, we get all kinds of calls with suggestions like that from riders. And barring a medical issue, the Masterson method is usually very beneficial in making life easier for trainers and riders, and obviously the horse feels better along the way too.
Now, do you see horses that have been referred from veterinarians? Do you recommend that they go through their veterinarian first when you're talking to the owner, or can they come directly to you and then you consult with the veterinarian? What's the relationship you have there? And do you partner with other methodology in with this method?
Well, I also run a boarding stable, so I have a lot of horses in my barn, and I also personally own and ride a lot of horses, and I have very close relationships with my veterinarians that come out, and I've made sure that they all understand the Masterson method and the work that I do. And I do get referrals from vets. When a lot of vets are chiropractors, but they don't, honestly, they just don't have the time to do what we do, because it is time intensive to let the horse take all the time they need in releasing tension in the muscles. And so that's the muscular system, as Dr. Carrie Ridgway recently wrote. The muscular system is sort of a forgotten muscle system, according to him, and he as a vet. And so the tools for dealing with muscle tension are not, other than some more invasive things like medicines or mesotherapy, they're not areas of expertise generally of veterinarians. And so I do partner, because a lot of vets are chiropractors, and they have found that the adjustment is easier to get and stays in longer when the horse has had body work, either right before the adjustment or right after the adjustment. And so veterinarians have gotten very comfortable with having Masterson method work done alongside of their work with the horses. Also, if a horse has had some kind of injury and compensation patterns have set in into the muscle patterns, as the medical part of healing occurs, lots of times those horses need help getting their muscular system back in balance as they go back to work. And the Masterson method, it can be extremely helpful with those horses getting back into the daily regime of training again.
Let's talk a little bit about the connection with the horse and rider then, how you're adjusting the horse and benefits the rider. There's some biomechanics happening there. Unpack that for us, if you would, Carly.
Well, it's a fascinating thing, and there are so many benefits that I didn't that never would have occurred to me when I started getting into the Masterson method that certainly helped the horse, helped the relationship, and then have helped me as to be a better rider. The Masterson method benefits any breed or type of horse working in any discipline, but the method of body work that we practice releases tension in the soft tissues of the horse, but restores range of motion to the joints. This is important to do because over time, the muscle systems of even the best ridden horses start to get unbalanced as a horse works in his regular schedule. The muscles start to lose their elasticity due to tension developing over time. And the techniques we use in the Masterson method reset the muscular system back to neutral by releasing tension at the site, but also by releasing more tension through movement of a joint in a relaxed state. Now, these movement releases in the Masterson method echo the way a dressage horse is uniquely required to use his body in the many dressage movements. So consequently, it is especially helpful for the dressage horse. But there are many surprise benefits for the dressage horse and his rider in learning this method. First, you get to know your horse's body really, really well, and it's a great way to connect with your horse. It's a real relationship builder to learn the Masterson method and to practice it on your own horse. Additionally, using skills you learn in our Masterson method training programs, you can determine, for example, before the ride, how are his pole and back today? After the ride, you can ask yourself, as I do, did I make him better or worse the way I rode today? Am I still sitting too hard on my right seat bone or still overusing my left inside hand? The feedback is powerful in making you clean up your riding. Because like it or not, we leave footprints of ourselves in the musculoskeletal system of our horses because they are remarkably sensitive creatures. I even lunge differently since I've learned the Masterson method because I understand now what it really is all about, asking the horse to learn to release tension in his body and what it looks like when he does, when I watch him moving over the ground. But I found that there are some additional surprise benefits of learning the method that has helped my riding as a dressage rider. I'm a very right-handed person, and I've benefited from getting my left hand smarter and my hands better able to work together and independently. And I've also dramatically increased the sensitivity of my hands. Most of all, I've learned to feel the horse brace and then gain the discipline to override my human instinct to take more tightly in response to that brace and instead to yield slightly to the brace. And then as soon as the horse softens, to ask again. This sensitivity and timing is at the heart of the Masterson method. But it also applies to fine riding, and it's helped me a great deal set up a better communication with my horse when I ride and be more in sync with the horse.
Now, I know some listeners are going to be thinking, well, I use a massage for my horse, I use chiropractor, I use shockwave, you know, all the various modalities that are out there available. And distinctly, what would they get from this modality that they wouldn't get from maybe the massage that they're currently using as a multimodality of equine massage that you're presenting?
Well, I have used a lot of different other modalities on my horses. And I don't want to say anything negative about any modality because there are a lot of very fine practitioners and there's a lot of benefit that can come from all the modalities. There's probably room for everything. It's a very big tent working on horses. But I can give you, I can say with confidence, because it's happened over and over again, that I have people coming to my classes. I teach the advanced class as well as the introductory weekend class. And I have a lot of people that come that are highly proficient at other bodywork modalities. And when they leave, they tell me that they don't need to do the other modality anymore because this is complete. And it was simpler, and sometimes they'll even say it was more effective than what they were doing before. So I let other people make that statement I, in my own experience, because I started doing this for my own horses, my experience is that the benefit lasts longer than what I was used to. And if my horse needs a chiropractic adjustment, which is less and less often as the horses get regular Masterson method body work, the adjustment stays much longer. I can tell that benefit. But the looseness that they acquire stays much longer, barring some hidden medical thing that just hasn't truly surfaced yet. But it's also, that's a great benefit. If I do the Masterson Method body work on one of my horses, and then in a week, a certain unusual pattern of tightness comes back, I look first at my riding. Am I doing something different? And if I'm convinced that I'm not the culprit, then that gives me an indication that there's something brewing that I need to take a look at. And I'll call my vet very often that, you know, there's something in this area that's happening that's is a new pattern, and it's a pattern that's a negative pattern, but it's a new pattern that's setting in, causing tension and restriction in the horse. And so the vet usually goes to work, and then ultimately we end up finding something that it was subclinical still. But so over the long haul, I'm helping my horses to stay sounder and healthier, I believe.
Well, you mentioned the training, obviously, the seminars, the workshops, that you can become a certified practitioner through your system. Do you have to have any prerequisites there for that course? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, any owner, you came to it as being an owner, maybe not medically trained. Does anyone need any pre-training, anything at all that would help them to complete your course? What would you suggest to anyone who's listening?
Well, I think being able to feel comfortable around horses is important. And so most horse owners would fit in that category. Basic horse handling skills is certainly helpful. And we help people fill that gap if they are just very, very eager in learning the Masterson Method, but they're a human massage therapist and they want to branch out into horses, but they have a weakness there. We help them to make connections and contacts that help them to fill in that gap. But certainly you need to be comfortable working with the horse's body and picking up their legs and that sort of thing. But people get better at all of that as part of the Masterson Method.
Right.
But otherwise, almost anybody who loves horses can learn to do the Masterson Method. And we teach it all over the world now. The Masterson Method has a rigorous and robust training program with several levels of classes so that an individual can learn as much as they want about the method. And for those that desire it, we have a rigorous certification program of mentoring and field work. And Jim Masterson then personally certifies every person that accomplishes that certification process.
Right. So anyone can find information about this on your website, of course, at mastersonmethod.com. But give us an idea of what the costs would be to embark on a course and ultimately become a practitioner with a certification.
Well, I don't keep up very well with the cost, so all that information is on the Masterson Method, all one word, mastersonmethod.com. And you can learn about the method and where the courses are that are being taught and what the costs are. And honestly, I'm not 100% sure what the current costs are. It's for the weekend, it's around $400, I believe, and I'm not sure what the advanced class, the week-long class is actually, but it's all on the website. Mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of YouTubes that people can watch of Jim Masterson demonstrating techniques and working on horses, and we have books and DVDs available. We even have an online course, online introductory course that people like to take. The Beyond Horse Massage book and DVD you can find through booksellers as well as off the website, and that's introductory material that goes along with the weekend class. For the dressage aficionado, we have a DVD of Betsy Steiner riding a Grand Prix dressage horse that's been painted with the skeleton and the major muscle groups by Susan Harris. The name of this DVD is Dressage Movements Revealed. And on it, you get to watch Betsy performing all of the dressage movements in slow motion on a painted horse. And it's a huge education for the rider, as you can see which muscles and how the skeleton works. The second DVD of that two DVD set shows Jim working on one of Betsy's dressage horses, doing a complete dressage horse bodywork session. And we've also recently published a companion book to the Dressage Movements Revealed DVD. And that book is entitled Dressage Horse Optimized. And it has fabulous pictures and discusses the basic biomechanics of dressage, as well as teaching some basic Masterson method techniques. So there are lots of ways to get introduced to the Masterson method before you go to the courses. But ultimately, people always want to go to the course because feel and timing is everything in the Masterson method. And hands-on help, someone live in person helping you to get that, is usually where everybody ends up. But there's a lot of opportunity for experimenting on your own with the books and the DVDs and the online basics course before going to taking the classes.
Right. So do your homework on the muscular skeletal frame of the horse and apply at mastersonmethod.com. Now, give us an idea, Coralie, before you leave. How long, if someone dedicated their time, they came on a course, they'd done their homework, how long would it take to become a certified practitioner if time was unlimited for them?
Yeah, time is unlimited because life just does get in the way. It's a reality. But I can speak from my perspective. Once I saw Jim working and I found out very quickly off one of the initial DVDs how much it was going to help a horse I was really worried about. And I became not just a little obsessive compulsive in learning this method. And I saw it in August. I got some initial DVDs. I was in the weekend class in November. I did the required anatomy work. Over the next several months, I went to the advanced five-day class in January, and then I went into the certification class and became certified the next September. So it's a very, very rigorous training program, and I think that's one thing that I'm so proud of about the Masterson method, because Jim does take it very seriously. Anybody can learn it, but there is a necessity to learn how to do it and to learn how to be proficient and sensitive to a variety of different horses, because the horses ultimately do the teaching, and they teach us how to get really good at it and to get the right sensitivity and feel. So people usually take 1 to 2 years to get through the whole certification phase. But it's well worth it because you really, really learn how to do a lot and provide a lot of benefit to a lot of horses by going through the certification. And then you can advertise yourself as a certified Masterson Method practitioner. And on the website, if someone is looking for a certified practitioner, there's a map where you can a map of the United States or now of the world, where you can identify where you are and where someone is close to you and how to contact them so that you can find a certified practitioner. And when you become one, then you get on the map so that people can find you.
You get on the map, and you can also charge for these services. And not to put you on the spot here, Coralie, but in a ballpark figure, what would one treatment usually cost? Just a ballpark.
The recommendation from Jim is that it needs to fit with the local market, and so he suggests that people with experience and competency that they charge in relationship with the human massage market.
Okay,
and that that can vary according to where a person is.
Right. Okay. Well, that will be some gauge for people listening if they want to take this up. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the program, Coralie, and explaining the Masterson method to us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's a exciting topic to learn about, and it never gets old because the horses are always teaching us more.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can read a preview of the Dressage Horse Optimized on the eTrack section of the website, where you'll find a sample chapter. The USDF online store is currently carrying Dressage Horse Optimized and other dressage-specific books and educational material. All USDF members get 10% off in the USDF online store. You'll also find a link to the sample chapter and the USDF online store in the show notes accompanying this episode. And now for our education segment, we're joined again by USDF certified instructor faculty member Sarah Martin to elaborate on an article that she wrote for the May issue of USDF Connection magazine entitled Snaffle or Double. Hi Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Chris. It's nice to talk to you.
Where did the premise for that come from, Sarah?
It's a conversation, really, Chris, that goes on with all dressage trainers and riders as they try to make the decisions as they're training horses along as to whether to keep the horse in a snaffle bridle or move them into a double bridle. And definitely there are reasons to choose one or the other at different points in time and at different points in the horse's training. It also is really affected by the horse's body type. So there are quite a few ingredients that go into making that decision, and it is absolutely a huge topic in terms of dressage trainers and riders learning when it's time to make the shift, if you will.
That was going to be my first question, actually, Sarah. You know, it is the timing. I know listeners will be thinking, okay, well, how young can we put them in a double bridle? So give us an idea of the time frame in the actual training of a young horse.
In general, we wait to introduce a double bridle until the horse has developed his muscles enough to be at a stage of solid, collected work. And that's why in the tests, you don't see double bridles introduced at second level. Second level is the beginning of collection in the horse's body. And we don't need a double at that point in time. But as the horse has to start to shift back and carry more and more weight on the hindquarter and really stay back there, that's when you can see the double bridle coming into play. So for horses that are developing the balance for a very solid third level, for being able to make the flying changes and being tweaked to staying on the hind leg, generally I confirm my horses in the flying changes in a snaffle, but then I can use the double to help them when it comes time for things like tempi changes, being able to stay back more, starting to make canter pirouettes, the shortening the stride and canter. So you could think of it as the fourth level work, but certainly we'll start introducing it at third level just so that they learn to carry the bridle, to be comfortable in it, and to start to understand the differentiation between what an aid on the snaffle bit does and what an aid from the curb ring does.
Let's step back to the training arena, Sarah, with the first use of this and how often. And just talk us through those very first days when you decide that you're going to put the double on the horse for the first time, how often, how long you would ride them in, and how often and when you would pick up the curb, that sort of thing.
For that, if I'm introducing a horse to the double bridle for the first time, my criteria is that the horses really are comfortable in their body. They understand how to take a half halt. They understand how to shift their weight back from the rider's leg and seat. Once that is happening, then what I generally do is put the double bridle on the first time and simply walk the horse under saddle. I allow them to carry the bridle. Again, you have a little bit of a differentiation if you have horses who are very mouthy or who are a little bit shy about the bridle. Those are horses that I'm going to give a longer time to simply, say, walk in the arena, get comfortable with the idea that they can have this heavier bridle and these two bits in their mouth without having to layer in the work that goes with it. So for a more tentative horse or a horse who's a little more cautious about his mouth, that might be a week that they go into the arena wearing the double bridle, carrying it until they're comfortable, and then maybe the work, they get switched back into a snaffle bridle and go to work. For a horse who's confident in the bridle, and I have to say, in the bulk of my experience, most of my horses have hardly even noticed when the double bridle goes on. For those horses, I might, for the first 2 days, let them just carry the double bridle in the arena, and then we go to work as always. It's no big deal. Because in the double, you can work them completely off the snaffle. So it's possible to let the curb just be passive. So really, truly, I would say not more than 1 or 2 days of wearing it before I'm just going to work with it. Then the next question is, when do you start influencing with the curb? And basically, once they have gotten comfortable wearing the duggle, understanding the lateral flexion, I'll do a little bit of work and walk with all the lateral movements, a little shoulder in, haunches in, half pass. Then you just pick it up like regular work and go forward in the trot, over their back. And as you warm up the body, you take up a little bit of feeling on the curb, and then the curb is there for a little bit of additional support in the half halt. You generally get quite a nice feeling of the horse going, wow, this is a little more important that I get my weight back there. And it does give you the ability to fine tune them. So you just, through the feeling of the horse, are able to start using the curb in small ways. And hopefully that's the way it stays through your time as you develop the horse. There can always be situations where you have horses who have been a little bit ruined in the mouth or a little bit strong, or say they're older FEI schoolmasters that, or maybe they're not such masters, but FEI horses that have been used and ridden very strongly in a double bridle. And they'll tend to get a little stronger against the curb. And those horses, actually, I'll take back and reschool in a snaffle and use perhaps a lunging cabeçon or a rope halter to get them sensitive again in conjunction with the snaffle, and then reintroduce the curb where it's not the curb that they're used to pushing on, and they've been retrained to get light in their neck and soft in the half halts again. So it's kind of a full circle aspect, whether the horse is new to the bridle or whether they're getting retrained in the bridle.
There may be some listeners, Sarah, who maybe have not had that much experience of riding in a double even, and a horse that they're taking up to another level. What sort of do's and don'ts would you advise them when they're actually getting used to riding with two reins themselves?
You know what we do at our barn is I absolutely have my riders ride with two reins before they get to introduce a curb bit. So using a lunging cabeçon, I will attach an extra set of reins to the lunging cabeçon and have them learn to use the lunging cabeçon a little bit like a curb rein, and carrying the snaffle rein for its usual function. The other thing that I'll do is take draw reins and put them underneath the thigh block of the saddle so that the rider can really get sensitive to the idea that if they take those reins too short, they can visually see how that impacts the horse and starts to limit their ability to use themselves longitudinally. So I make sure that my riders are comfortable with two reins before we introduce the double bridle. Then layering in the double bridle, they already have an awareness of what it is to carry two reins and what that influence is. And for different riders, it's a little bit like horses. Different riders, it takes different amounts of time. But truly, it's something that you need to practice for weeks, if not a month or more, before switching into a double bridle, just because the curb rein needs to be understood and you need to have that second sense in your hand of which rein is which. And I find this a very good way to do it.
And give us some other pointers as to what was in the article itself, Sarah. What did you focus on?
Oh, we talked about so many things when we did that article. One of the ideas was, you know, how do you select a bit? Do you choose which bradoon do you choose? Which type of curb bit do you choose? And then we also went through the idea of what it is that you're looking for in the horse in terms of them accepting the double. What tells you if the horse has accepted the feeling of the double bridle. And again, it's no mystery. It's the same thing that you look for in regular snaffle work. You don't want to see a horse overly anxious in the mouth. You don't want to see a huge amount of salivation. You don't want to see the tongue coming in and out. You want the horse to be quiet in its eye and quiet in its mouth. So those factors affect what you do in choosing the size of bit, the diameter. And it's important to know that when you're looking at bits, say you're looking in a catalog, you'll have listed not only the width, which is measured from the inside bar to the inside bar of the curb or the inside bit ring on the snaffle, but also the diameter. And it used to be that people felt that big, fat, round bits were easier. And both Chris Hickey, who was my co-consult for that article, and I feel that actually a little bit of a thinner in diameter curb gives the horse a little bit more room in their mouth. And so we both tend to like a little bit more the thinner bits and not a very high port. But, of course, that leads to the whole dynamic of what is the horse's mouth shaped like and the whole education for riders about, you know, does my horse's jaw, is it a very sharp, pointy jawbone or is it a little bit more flat? Is my horse's tongue wide and fat or is it narrow and mobile? You know, a lot of time older horses will let their tongue sort of relax and stick out between their teeth a bit, and you have to find a bit that allows enough room for the tongue so that the horse isn't inclined to then really drop his tongue and let it off to the side. So it's important that people really look into the reasons for the different shapes and types of bits. It becomes a whole other topic unto itself, but we talked about that a bit in the article. And the thing that we both really were quite clear about also, Chris and I, was that it's important to not put a snaffle on a pedestal or a double bridle on a pedestal. These are tools. They're tools to be used and to be understood and to understand how to use them. And there's no great virtue in staying in a snaffle. There's no great virtue or sin in progressing to a double. These are, again, you will find that as you're learning and as you're training your horse, it really is a wonderful tool to be able to take them into the double bridle and to get to the point where they can wear a double. And if you want snaffle influence, you use the snaffle. And if you need the curb, you use it. And if you don't need it, it's there if you do. So there's so much to the whole idea of not only the use of the double bridle, but the fitting of it and the fitting of the bits. I suspect that we will see more articles because it just opens up a whole field of study.
And, of course, very important for our listeners to be educated on the whole process of choosing that bit, the right bridle for the horse when you start them off, and maybe that they need changing through their career as well. So there's a lot to learn on the subject, as you said, Sarah. Are there any final tips that you have for our listeners on what they need to know when they're using a double bridle and many particular points in the article that you want to draw their attention to?
You know, the final thing that I would say is the use of the double bridle also can incorporate different ways to hold the reins, and that is worth getting educated about and finding out more about. The biggest flaw that we see in the use of the double bridle is that riders unconsciously somehow always creep up on the curb. It's just uncanny how the snaffle will get loose and the curb will get tight. And that is the major thing that riders really, truly have to spend time with so that they develop that second sense of where is the snaffle bit and what is my feeling in the snaffle bit so that they don't unconsciously creep up on that curb and end up punishing their horse unintentionally because they've started to make aids through the curb rein that they did not intend to do. And that's when the double bridle ceases being a tool and becomes a weapon. And it's very important that riders educate themselves and really study the process of how to separate the reins and spend the time doing exercises where they're very, very focused on, am I communicating through the snaffle and not just blindly communicating over both reins.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and expanding on your article in the May issue of the USDF Connection magazine, Snaffle or Double. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you, Chris.
And now, in the first of a three-part series on back pain in the dressage horse, we're joined by Dr. Meyer of the Meyer Equine Clinic in Rochester, New Hampshire. This segment is taken from an education session recorded at the 2015 Adequan USDF Annual Convention entitled The Science and Treatment of Back Lameness.
What you'll get from me is science. I'm a scientist. I love science, and everything is evidence-based. Now, that doesn't mean that I have all the answers. I wish I did. And it doesn't mean that if you don't have all the science backing you up, that it doesn't work. They have something that has, you know, science behind it. Then that's really where you should start. That's your starting point to whether something is going to work or not. And before you do that, you have to diagnose it. You have to know where the problem is coming from. It doesn't do you any good if the problem is in the horse's head and you're working on the tail, or if it's in the tail and you're working on the head. You have to be able to know where it's coming from. That's difficult. It's always been difficult. Well, Rogers said, you know, that being a veterinarian is one of the more difficult things because we have to interpret what the horse says. You all do that all the time, too. I mean, you interpret the horse when you're riding the horse and how it responds, and I have a lot of admiration for you. I'm basically a cowboy when I ride. I grew up in the Midwest, and I have a lot of respect for dressage riding, and I don't think I'm quite good enough to do that, nor do I have the time to do that, because I know how much time it takes for you guys to do what you do. But you develop a communication with your horse that is vitally important. It's to make the diagnosis. And when there's something wrong, you know, when I see the horse, I have to know a lot about this anatomy, and I still go back and forth anatomy books to find that fine detail when I'm diagnosing, when I'm using fancy imaging, whether it's MRI or whether it's nuclear medicine or whatever. But the most important thing in diagnosing it, the problem, is the clinical exam. Far more important than anything else. And you cannot replace that with all the fancy, expensive modalities that I have in my armamentarium. However, they do enhance my diagnostic capabilities tremendously. It's interesting, we're talking about back lameness. We have a different approach in the United States than you do in Europe. I think Europe, they like to center on the back and then find the distal limb. We go from the distal limb and work our way back up to the back. And maybe there's a compromise there someplace that we should be looking at. I know my opinion of back lameness, per se, has certainly changed over the years, and I'll talk to you about how that's changed. I'm going to give you a lot of examples and cases. Now, some of the things you can see, not only just feel, and again, I'll get into how you tell me a lot when you come to me and say, you know, the horse is has difficulty working to the right, the left, or in a half halt, or half pass, or passage, or whatever. My job is then to look at the horse and physically and determine any physical abnormalities. If we look at ourselves, our own ailments, I know I have a bit of a scoliosis because I have a back problem, lower back problem. And I have that because that's how I move away from the pain. Pain is the real cause of everything there. If we could eliminate the pain, then we would not have scoliosis, acquired scoliosis, and my back would be straighter, and I'd feel a lot better, that's for sure. So we talked about evidence-based medicine, but then in localizing where that's coming from, we have to have some sound evidence to diagnose that. All too often, I think we use empirical information, things that is not science per se, and there's an art to it, perhaps. And I think I see that aspect in Europe more than we have here. We like to block things out. We use some Novocaine. If we can block it out, then we know that that's the area where the lameness or pain is coming from. In the back, that's very difficult to do. You can, I know Sue Dyson, she and Mike Ross wrote the book Lameness in the Horse, a very good book, and she will actually block out that sacroiliac joint. I've blocked some of those, and I've also, the sciatic nerve runs right there, and so I've had them actually almost go down from that. So I have given that up, but I think there are better diagnostic tests than that without the danger involved with it. So here are just a few examples of things that can go wrong. Internal organ pain. That can cause back soreness. We hear about kidneys all the time. That's a rarity, but there are some things that can cause that. We have neurologic problems. That's why you want to have your veterinarian look at them, because sometimes it's not pain related. Now, how can I tell whether it's pain related or not? One way you can do this, and this is a very simple thing, is using a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. So if you come to me and you say, okay, I put them on bute, for a day, and it didn't change anything. Well, you have to do more than that. And bute's only one of the non-steroidals. Just like us, when we take, you know, does Tylenol work better for you, or ibuprofen, or there's an individual variance there too. But you should get some response if there is a inflammatory component to the lameness. So if you, and I'd like you to put them on for like a week, maybe 2 weeks. And you can, on a 1,000, 1,200, 1,400 pound horse, you can generally give a gram of bute morning and night and not have to worry about that. Now, you want to probably run that by your veterinarian if you have any ulcer problems with the horse. This is my disclaimer, by the way. You know, you want to be careful with that. A therapeutic dose would be 2 grams morning and night, but you wouldn't want to keep them on that for very long. And then I tell people to vary the dose a little bit and see what works the best, or if it works at all. So if it works and you see a benefit to your horse on an anti-inflammatory, you've got an inflammatory problem. And that bears investigation. It also tells me that it is reversible. So it isn't so chronic like that scoliosis horse, but it's reversible. That's a good sign. If it's reversible, it means that if we can diagnose it and we can change the course, whether it's biomechanically or whether it's through surgery or however, then we can make the horse better. So we've ruled out a neurologic problem. The degeneration is going to have, degenerative problem is going to have some degree of inflammation. So is the bone and joint disease and soft tissue, too. So, again, that's an important aspect that we try to determine whether there's an inflammatory component. So then once we've said that, okay, there is a problem there one way or another, how are we going to diagnose it or to diagnose it more fully? A physical exam, just like I said, the most important thing. And that's not just watching them jog. Because when I'm looking at them, you have to put your hands on them. You want to know, is there any heat anyplace? Is there any swelling anyplace? Anything that's abnormal? You want to know, is there pain? Pain's difficult to tell sometimes on palpation. And you can't always tell. The back is this mammoth structure, and it's very hard to get elicit pain, but you can do that sometimes. And palpation is in that area. I think the sacroiliac area, I can generate more response to that than any other place. I also run my fingers down the dorsal spinous processes right on top and see if I get pain. You got to push fairly hard. But one thing you don't want to do, people will come up to me and say, well, if I push right there, Well, you're putting, I mean, anybody's going to respond to that. The horse especially, they don't know what's happening. So that what I like to do is get my hands, I introduce myself to the horse, let him smell me, and then I put my hands on him, and then I continue to put more pressure on him. And if I can put pressure on and I get them to respond one way or another, then I realize, then I understand that there's a problem or likely to have a problem there. The other thing you can do is what Dr. Denoit taught me is a response test. So when I'm on one side of the horse, I'll reach over on the lumbar thoracic area and I'll just press my fingernails in. Okay, so then they're going to respond, or they should respond. If I can't get them to move, that tells me that they're reluctant to move because it hurts someplace. And if I go to the other side and they move, well, then I know which side it's on. So response tests are important, too. It is a subjective test, but a very good test. You can even go back to the gluteals, do the same thing, and they should scoot up a little bit. And if they do that, then, again, that's normal. If they don't do that, then I'm thinking maybe something in the sacroiliac area, which is still a very large area. We talked a little bit about regional anesthesia, especially up in the back. But I like to do regional anesthesia down low if I see one leg that's more lame and it's not a generalized back problem. Because maybe you have something that's contributing that's in the foot, the hock, the stifle, wherever, someplace down lower. We'll talk a little bit about that later, too. And then response to treatment. I think that's very helpful when I can ascertain, because even with some of the diagnostic modalities, I oftentimes will come up with 3, 4, 5 different areas that are affected by some abnormality. So by treating those areas, and not treating them all at one time, shotgunning, if you will, treat one or two at a time, then you're going to be able to, and I always take the worst ones, if I can get a response to that, then I know that's the problem, or the most significant problem. Sometimes it's more than one. You don't just have one problem. We like to have that. We're always looking for that silver bullet, right? You just want, if I can just give them EPM or Lyme disease or something, and then everything's going to be fine. I'm just going to treat that. It's rare that that happens. Speaking of like Lyme disease, which is New Hampshire has the highest incidence of Lyme disease in the United States. We're very high there now. So we see that, and a lot of horses have that. It rarely causes lameness. And I'm not saying it can't. It can cause a polyarthritis. But I did a study that we had 100 horses. It was actually for a diagnostic SNAP test, which works very well diagnosing Lyme disease. It's 96% effective. But out of all those horses, none of them, they were referred to me, and none of them had lameness associated with Lyme disease. There was a third of them had Lyme titers, so that they had the disease or had the disease, and they responded to treatment, but it was more of an attitude that the owners would see. They mellowed out, they ate better, they felt better, and any of us that have gone through flu or whatever, or even Lyme disease, know that it can be devastating, but more commonly, I think it's a lower grade disease problem, and so it does not cause lameness very often.
And we'll be continuing this series in the next episode of the USDF podcast. Jennifer Bryant reported on this session in the May issue of the USDF Connection magazine, which is currently available in print and also on the website, and also through the USDF Connection app. And finally, we would like to draw your attention to the USDF's Circle of Friends, which is essential to the mission of the USDF, and you can support the future of dressage by donating to the USDF Circle of Friends. Your tax-deductible gift will have a significant impact in helping the USDF, providing quality dressage education and programs. You can find a link on the website. Just look for usdf.org, online giving site, in the show notes accompanying this podcast, or you can call 859-971-7826 to make your contribution. And that's it for this week's episode. You can find this podcast online at usdf.org or also via iTunes in the podcast store to download to any mobile device. As well as the website and the Connection app, you can also follow us on social media at Facebook and Twitter. Until next week, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.